There was an ancient Greek philosopher that nearly every school child learns about named Heraclitus, whose most famous statement was, "You can never step in the same river twice." Heraclitus believed that change, flux, strife were at the heart of reality. That fire was the best symbol because fire is always moving, always changing, of what is really real. From that time on, men have been aware that life is in a state of flux. It's basically not expectable, unpredictable. Heraclitus has another statement that's not quite as well known. He says, if one to find the unexpected, one must expect it because it's very difficult to find. Well, that's a strange thing. To find the unexpected, one must expect it. But he was saying that change is so certain that one has to look for things that one doesn't expect to find in order really to find those things. Modern science has its own way of saying that at the base of reality, things are unpredictable. Heisenberg's principle of indeterminacy. Put in the simplest forms, about the only forms I can understand from that discipline, says that when you try to locate an electron, it's so small that in the very process of positioning it and locating it, measuring it, or whatever one does in his attempt to examine it, he changes it. He affects it, perhaps moves it in some way. At the subatomic level, scientists talk about wavicles these days. Small bits of matter in motion, which are not really particles and they're not really waves. They behave a bit like both, so they're just called wavicles. Instances where something appears here and appears there and doesn't seem to traverse the distance in between. Or there's Einstein's theory of relativity, which says, among other things, that a stationary clock runs faster than a moving clock. But I don't fully understand that. I understand it a little better when he says that if you're moving 40 miles an hour in this direction in a car, but you meet another car traveling 40 miles an hour in the other direction, you really meet at 80 miles an hour. Because the speed is determined somewhat by the position or the movement of the observer. Things are relative. In all of that, there's a reminder that at the base of reality, not everything is as fixed as we thought it was. Until the beginning of this century, it was assumed that the universe was tightly bound up with laws, that man had pretty well unfolded it. We knew what it was about and how it would behave. Nothing ever supersedes those laws. Nothing ever sets them aside. Cause always produces effect, closed universe. 20th century is not nearly so sure the universe is closed. Lauren Isley, one of the most famous scientists of our generation, has a book called The Unexpected Universe. And of course, anytime a preacher thinks of things like that, he begins to see parallels and to think of how unexpected what God did in the world really was, particularly in the way he did it, the unexpected Christ. To talk about Christ as unexpected, God's way of working in the world being a way man would not have predicted, is a bit strange because nothing had ever been predicted more. Was anyone ever expected more than Jesus was? If one goes through history, certain dates begin to stand out because of important people. On February 15, 1564, Michelangelo died. The same day, Galileo was born. 2 months later, April 23rd, Shakespeare was born. Those three people have shaped our thinking, but nobody expected either one of them. There'd been no predictions. There was no anticipation. But here we have an individual who had been preceded by centuries of prophets. They'd foretold his coming, and yet when he came, the method of his coming was so different from what had been expected that he was totally unexpected. Oh, one nation had been looking for him for centuries. Every time somebody unusual came, they thought it would be he. John the Baptist surely was the Messiah. Anytime there was a new teacher in the wilderness or in the city, somebody had to be sent to see if he's the one who's supposed to come, or do we look for somebody else? But in spite of all that, when Christ came, he was still not expected. Malcolm Muggeridge, famous British writer of this century, editor for a long time of Punch, British magazine of humor and satire, was reared in a home which was an agnostic home. He himself spent much of his life as a skeptic. But he observed through life the various promises made to men, the great society here, the utopia there. And having observed them for years, he finally made a speech after his retirement to a British university student body. And he rehearsed the various hopes he'd had through life for man's utopia. And he said, "I don't know about you, but as for me, it's Jesus Christ or nothing." A man who had come from a home of unfaith, but through observation had reached the conclusion that faith in Christ was the only area in which there lay any hope. But Muggeridge comments in his little book, Jesus Rediscovered, which is the story of his rediscovery of Jesus Christ, that on the day when he was born, there was probably not a child born anywhere in the world who seemed to have poorer prospects. And I suspect that's true. It just hadn't been expected that way. And when he came, no one would have thought much would happen out of or as the result of this birth. What they really expected was someone who would come and liberate Israel from Roman rule. Instead, Jesus was interested in liberating Israel and all other people from Satan's rule, from sin, from guilt. They expected someone to come with a love of law. The law wasn't being respected. Someone who would not only instill in the young a desire to do the law of Moses, but all of those laws that accumulated around the law of Moses. Jesus came and said not one jot or one tittle would pass from the law of Moses till all was fulfilled, but he didn't have much respect for those other laws that had accumulated. So instead of instilling a love of law in the young, he began to talk about a law of love and to instill in people a badge of discipleship. People will know you're my disciples if you love one another. They expected a Messiah to come and make life easier for them. Maybe lower the taxes, lower the prices, raise the employment rate. In some way, make life more bearable. Instead, he came and talked about crosses instead of crowns, and his way of life seemed harder than any that had ever been proclaimed before. I think most of all, they expected someone to come who'd have a happy ending. We love a happy ending. Instead, Jesus came with stories about a group of girls who might have gone to a wedding had they been ready, but they found themselves locked on the outside, the door shut. He talked about a man who missed a wedding feast because he didn't accept the invitation when he came. He warned that the ending is not always happy. Consequently, being so different from what was expected, only the most discerning really understood him to be who he really was. There was Anna, that 84-year-old widow who stayed at the temple daily fasting and praying until the Messiah should come. There was the aged Simeon, who recognized him in infancy and said, "This child is set for the rise and fall of many in Israel." But most didn't recognize him. Same thing still happens. We expect Christ to come today in certain ways. I think we can talk of the comings of Christ. The Old Testament constantly talks of God coming. He comes in judgment. He comes in deliverance for his people. The New Testament does the same thing about Christ. He comes in the clouds of heaven, but it happens during the lifetime of that generation as his kingdom starts, an obvious reference to the beginning on Pentecost, not to his final coming. And he still comes. We expect him to come, in a sense, through the Lord's Supper, where we draw close to him, through baptism, where we observe a person born into his family, through sermon and song and prayer. But then the unexpected happens. If you'd asked me 10 years ago, where do you think in 1980 most of the conversions will be occurring in America? Probably the last place I would have predicted would have been the college campus. But if you ask me today where most of the conversions are occurring, I'd say more people are being converted to Christ today on college campuses than any place else I know. And in so many other ways, just when we expect him to come through our well-structured manners and morals, somebody here whose life is broken to bits through sin has finally reached the place where he or she is willing to look to the Lord for leadership. And there comes the inbreak, and life is turned around. It isn't so strange that he should still come in our lives in unexpected ways. But at the center, and perhaps nearer the text in John 1 about the light who enlightens everyone who comes into the world, and his coming to his own not receiving him, the general tenor of men toward him. It seems to me that this is most clearly reflected in a mindset that's peculiarly modern. So many people seem to have decided that Jesus was a very great person. He's an important part of the past of the human race, but he is part of the past. He did live 7,000 miles and 2,000 years away from right here and right now, and who would expect in a day of nuclear fission and genetic engineering and space exploration that you should still go back to a Galilean peasant to find the way to really live? There's a mindset that says the human race has been progressing, and he helped that progress along, but we're reaching higher and higher plateaus, and there must be new insights somewhere that will replace the insights he brought. That seems to be such a subconscious part of our culture that we may not take his simple teaching seriously any longer. I want to question that whole syndrome. I don't believe the human race is progressing. At least not universally so. I believe we're making phenomenal progress in one field, the field we may broadly call the applied sciences, technology. Tremendous strides in the last century and a half. But apart from that, I don't believe we're making progress. And I want to illustrate in a general way. If you were given a chance to live either in the Greece of Pericles and Demosthenes, the Greece of glory, 5th and 4th century B.C., or the Greece of today, almost utterly lacking in culture, which would you choose, other things being equal? I'd rather live there then than now. If you could choose between the 12th dynasty in Egypt, 20th to 18th century B.C., when the Egyptians were learning more about geometry and medicine than anybody had ever known, or you had to live in Egypt in Sadat's day, which would you choose? Having seen this and read about that, all things else being equal, I would choose that over this. If you had to live in Persia in Xerxes' day, 4th century B.C., or in modern Persia, Iran, in Khomeini's day, would there be a very difficult choice to make? Are we really progressing? But it isn't just a general way. If we get very specific, look in any field you want other than the applied sciences. And I believe that you'll find a peak reached somewhere in human history which has never been approached since. And it looks like may never be again. I don't know much about sculpture. But the little bit that I've read indicates that there never has been a greater sculptor than Phidias, a man who lived in Greece in the 4th century B.C., 5th century rather, who made statues only of the gods of Greek mythology, made them in ivory, the drapery over their bodies were made in gold, designed the statuary for the Parthenon. Here was a peak in sculpture, never quite been equaled again, certainly not surpassed. Look at philosophy. The 20th century has brought her Bertrand Russells and her Eric Hoffers. Nobody who knows the field would say that the 20th century has even approximated 5th and 4th century B.C. when Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle came in succession, each influenced by the other since Socrates, and led man into thinking about what is real and how one can really know and where values are formed. Philosophy hasn't approached the greatness of ancient Greece again. Look at poetry. The 20th century has its Frosts and its Sandburgs and its Eliots. Drop back to the 16th century in England. Queen Elizabeth I is in her long reign. And you have Shakespeare and Ben Jonson and John Donne and Marlowe and Edmund Spenser. And no one who knows the field would say this century compares with that in its greatness. Look at religion. If we leave the claim of inspiration for the Bible, the 20th century has its Schweitzers and its Tillichs. But nobody who knows the field again would say that these men have the greatness, the originality of an Amos, a Hosea, an Isaiah, a Micah, all of whom lived in one small land in the 8th century B.C., 2,700 years ago. Are we progressing, or have we had our peaks? If you look at painting, I don't know much about abstract art. I don't understand it. But I assume that the most ardent admirer of abstract art would not say that it really compares with the Italian Renaissance, when Raphael and Michelangelo and Da Vinci and a dozen others were turning out masterpieces almost without limit. A peak. Music? I really don't know much about 20th century music, recent music especially. But I don't think anyone who looks at the field carefully would doubt that 18th and 19th century Germany reached a peak in music. When you had Mozart and Schubert and Bach and Beethoven and Brahms, and though we have greater instrumentation, we haven't approached their greatness, their originality. Why is it, if the human race is on an escalator and progress is automatic and we're getting better and better, that we haven't excelled the past in those fields? We're getting very close to the Christian claim. The Christian claim is that Jesus Christ was the peak, that he's unique in all human history, that the prophets came before him, the apostles came after him. Nobody can stand by him or alongside him. There's one different twist. We don't believe that's because Jesus was the highest upreach of man. We believe it's because he was the downreach of God, that he was unique, irreplaceable. That's a simple claim. But it does have a great deal of foundation if one looks at human history overall, that one should be able to look to a peak in the past rather than assuming that the present is automatically better. When you think it through, our needs really haven't changed for a long, long time. Open Genesis and read about the patriarchs. Read about them seriously and you'll discover that they had the same problems you have. They were as shifty, as greedy, as lustful, as jealous, and they were also as generous. They had as deep friendships and the same longings for God. They were as good and they were as bad as we are. Centuries and centuries ago, with their blood brothers, and you can't doubt it when you read them carefully. Read through the Gospels and look at the people whose lives Jesus touched. Here's a man who's been an invalid 38 years. And Jesus says, "Do you want to be well?" That always seemed a strange question to me till I really thought it through. I suppose a fellow who's been waited on hand and foot 38 years might not want to be well. That would bring a lot of responsibility. Jesus calls for a choice of the will. Do you really want to be whole? The habit that you and I are ashamed of, that weights us down and virtually makes a spiritual invalid of us, do we really want to be well of it? These people are not just so many individuals, they're types. Many other things he did that are not written in this book, these are written that we might believe him to be the Christ, the Son of God, and believing, have life through his name. As a type, there's a woman who's filled with passion, and Jesus deals with her and sends her on a different route through life. There's a man who's going to tear down his barns and build greater, expand his holdings, really enjoy the future, just like we do. And then there are those religious people who seem so fine, except that they have a spiritual hardening of the arteries, and Jesus has to work with them. And when you think it through, same needs, same Savior. It is an unexpected way. Had I been designing the salvation of the human race, I think I would have always put the goal a bit out in the future, never back in the past. But observe, and you'll see that spiritual progress comes in the 20th century in direct relationship to the way people turn back to the way of Jesus Christ. To the extent that we approach him, learn of him, and become loyal to him, to that extent we progress. Apart from that, we do not. I don't know if you've committed your life to him or not, but I do know this. There is no place else, there is no one else to whom you can go. If he isn't the answer, there isn't one. But it's an amazing thing that the Bible is always translatable into any language and understandable, because everywhere people have that sense of human sin, that awareness of a need for redemption, and this story makes sense to any human heart, because God knew us, and in an unexpected way, he planned for our reconciliation. Do you need to do his will? Would you? Always. Oh,